April 20th marks Behavioral Health Today's fourth anniversary. To celebrate our fourth year mark, we're releasing five shows this week, one episode each day. Two will be new shows, and three will be some of our favorites in the past year. We hope you enjoy all of them, both new and old, and we look forward to another year of bringing you trending and relevant content in behavioral and mental health.
Welcome to Behavioral Health Today, a Triad production. I'm your host, Dr. Graham Taylor, and today I'm joined by Neha Sangwan. Neha is the CEO and founder of Intuitive Intelligence and is focused on empowering individuals and organizations with effective communication tools. Neha is also an internal medicine physician, engineer, author, speaker, and communications expert, and now consults with top organizations like Google, American Express, and the American Heart Association. She has shared her work across three TED Talk stages, authored two books, and developed a comprehensive employee accountability program that connects the dots between job satisfaction, health, and performance. We're excited to have Neha with us today as we discuss how our early experiences and the message we receive in our lives impacts us, and how we can set the stage for burnout in later life. And we'll identify how we can use these early experiences to bridge a healing process. Neha, welcome to our show.
So good to be here.
It's really nice to have you. You know, you're an internal medicine physician and an engineer. And what got you into this field of wellness with this specific focus on burnout?
You know, burning out myself. There's nothing like some personal experiences in life that highlight the gap that no matter how much education you have and how much you learn in your head, that life is a lived experience. And, you know, falling into potholes is a great way to realize what's most important and how to prioritize it. Yeah. So I will tell you a little bit about that if that works.
We would love to hear that. I'd love to hear about potholes. There's a great book called There's a Hole in My Sidewalk. It's five short chapters. It's a great little read. So I'm gonna hold that pothole analogy there. Tell us about some of the potholes.
Sure. My parents in 1965, they came over from India with an arranged marriage and came to a country. They didn't know each other. They didn't know the country. Nice. And they got educated and had three daughters. They decided to stay here. Nice. So very young, I got sent away with my grandparents to live with them because of a whole series of experiences. But I spent 3 months to 2 years old with them. When I came back into my family, the reintegration was really hard for me. As you would expect, right? A child wouldn't want to leave. I thought my grandparents were my parents now. Mm-hmm. And so leaving them felt really hard. I realized that after a month of crying, that I wasn't going to get to go back no matter how hard I cried. So I did what I think a lot of us do that is just genius as children. We adapt to the environment that we're in. Yeah, sure. And what I did was I literally became a people pleaser. I got out of my own misery and crying and trauma and pain. And I decided that if I was going to survive in this world, it was time to look outside me and figure out what the world needed from me. And so I became what I now understand is a people pleaser, but like a masterful one. I could read a room. I knew what everybody else wanted from me. And I tuned out of my own body. So fast forward, I walk into the hospital. I'm a busy hospital doctor taking on more and more and more. It doesn't matter how much they give me, I'll take it on. And I walked in one day and I said to the nurse, Nina, can you please get me 40 mil equivalents of IV potassium for the gentleman in 636? And she said, Dr. Sangwan, are you okay? And it was that moment that I recognized that something might not be okay, but I didn't know what she was talking about. So I said, yeah, why? And she said, that's the fourth time in under 5 minutes you've asked me that same question. And I've answered you every time.
Wow.
And so I went on stress medical leave that day. I was literally not functioning. Mm. And I had missed all the signals in the middle that would have told me something otherwise. Throat constriction, stomach turning, not sleeping, taking longer and longer at work, waking up, not feeling rested, irritable, defensive, all sorts of things that were clues along the way. But from a very young age, I learned to tune out of me. I was a distraction. Yeah.
Absolutely.
The world was where I needed to be focused. And in that gap, I burned out.
I so appreciate you starting out this way. And one, just your candor and your transparency, but you're highlighting something that is so helpful for us to realize that oftentimes the ways that we cope, or maybe at times survive, while adaptive in that environment at that time, become later on the very areas that create a vulnerability for us that we may not see the cost of until maybe it's too late, or you know, something's happening where we make a mistake or something happens. But those very ways of coping become the very things that are problematic, that we don't even recognize that we're dealing with. And we learn to shut out and tune out because our needs are greater than the cost of managing those moments. And then we're confronted with it and we have to stop, which is exactly what you did.
Yeah. And I didn't want to stop. Like, I'll tell you, when the nurse said that, I went to the bathroom and I thought, okay, maybe something's wrong, because I don't really remember saying the same thing four times. But if she's telling me, I believe her. So I went into the bathroom and I called a colleague and I just said, you know, could I see you sometime today? It was a psychiatric colleague. Uh-huh. And he said, yeah, how about 5 o'clock today, Neha? And it was like 11 in the morning. And I looked at my pale face in the mirror and I said, how about now?
Yeah.
That's just code for
now.
This is an emergency. Right. So the way I communicated it wasn't actually what I needed. And it took an hour for him to listen to me and hear that I was volunteering for every open night shift, that people wouldn't be there for fear that I wasn't keeping up my oath to my patients. Mm-hmm. It was my job to show up for them. I didn't like it when they were understaffed. I knew things didn't go well when we don't have enough people. So I took on a lot of responsibility that wasn't mine. And now what I understand is, early in my life, that little girl who didn't understand why she couldn't be with her grandparents decided that she must have done something wrong to be sent away. And I think after that, I just wanted to make sure in the world that I was showing up in the most earnest way, that something like that would never happen again. And what I didn't realize is the thing I thought was the most devastating, this was a similar level of unexpected to me, which was how humiliating. Like, I'm a doctor running transfers for the whole hospital, running my own 18 patients, all of these things. And now I'm in line to get my prescription for Prozac. Mm-hmm. Like, what, how could this be? Like, how could I be so clueless?
Yeah.
And then it became the 20-year journey to understand and put together the pieces of where are the gaps, not only for me in listening to the clues, but in our education, that I didn't even know what this was, that I somehow am a doctor, that I write people prescriptions for medical leave and paid time off. Mm-hmm. But I actually had no idea what this thing called burnout was.
Yeah.
You know, so I think there's a lack of us wanting to talk about it ever since the pandemic. I believe that there's been a lot more awareness, a lot more acceptance around all of this. But that taboo-ness of it all 20 years ago also played a role in why I didn't understand what was happening.
What I love, in addition to what you're saying right now, is, you know, we can say I'm working a lot of hours and I'm taking things on and, you know, work is stressed, my boss is demanding, and those are all real things in certain places of employment. But you're going back down to something that's even, I think, essential to examine if it's a part of one's burnout or one experiencing some of the symptoms that you're describing. You're talking about this wee little girl who once upon a time felt like she was being separated or sent away, and that separation anxiety is huge. There's nothing more powerful than the fear of separation. That's one of our greatest fears. We feel like we're going to die.
Yep.
And what you're saying here is, my fear was, then you found a really adaptive way to take care of yourself. If I become essential, if I take on responsibility,
yep,
I will be so essential that I will never be sent away, because the fear is, maybe it's me that gets sent away versus what can I do to prevent that risk from ever coming on. So little do we know that the very thing that protected us from that greatest fear that we could experience, and everybody is at risk for something like this.
Yeah.
We're doing these things unconsciously, but it comes into every other part of our lives where it sounds all good. I'm taking these things on and isn't it great? I'm performing, but I'm doing it out of a fear-based motive that I don't oftentimes understand. And what you're saying is we can bring that to our conscious level. We still want to take on things. We still want to help and make ourselves responsible and things like that. But we want to do it in a non-fear-based way, in a way that's balanced. And so I so appreciate this angle that you're bringing to this.
What I'm really hearing as you're speaking is, don't just pay attention to what people are doing. Pay attention to why they're doing it. So
exactly.
If someone, I'm going to make up something. Someone says, I want to lead my group by the time I'm 50 years old. I want to be the leader. I want to be the leader of the group.
Yeah.
The next question that I ask them is, awesome. What will it give you?
Yes.
Right? Because if people tell you what they want, the real question is, why do they want it? What
will it why?
And then you can understand whether it's something fear-based or whether it's something from a place of love. And you're exactly right that my fear, the way that I say it is, I was a busy doctor in the hospital, fueled by sugar, caffeine, and a fear of failure. What's so interesting is that fear will always lead me back to the crash, which is, I'm going to now, if I didn't want to be separated or not belong, right, in my family or whatever this is, in the end, what I'd say burnout, the shame storm that came over me, which was how we're all overloaded. I just gave them, my team, 16 more patients to see that they're going to have to divide out across the team. And what are they going to think of me that I couldn't, that I couldn't hack it, right? That I'm now on leave. I'm on medical leave. So the shame storm came again.
Yeah.
It came in a very different form than the two-year-old got it. But it certainly told me that there was something was band-aided over. It wasn't healed. And I really want to take this even on a bigger level, that it shows up so differently. It showed up in my relationships where I let people treat me poorly, but I just didn't want them to leave me.
You bet.
It showed up in my academics and athletics and how hard and mean I was to myself on the tennis court and how awful I was when I got a B instead of an A.
Absolutely. Absolutely. You know what I'm so appreciating? I think you're a psychologist in your other life, because you've got such a deep understanding of this fear-based piece. And what I'm appreciating too, Neha, is how hard it must have been for you to look in the mirror to see this paled complexion, to reach out and make that call. Because if you're unconsciously working off of this, well, if I'm not useful, if I'm not providing something, if I'm not taking on responsibility, do you know what's going to happen? I could be sent away.
Yep.
And so here you are having to bind all of that fear in order to do something that's right. And how excruciating at some level that fear had to have been to take that kind of risk, but to nonetheless reach out. And I think what you're also encouraging is that if others are experiencing this, we'll just kind of jump ahead here. If others are experiencing this and they've got to ask for help, it's going to be one level of shame. But it's going to be a whole nother level, likely, of fear of what does this say about me? What is my self-meaning in this that could put everything at risk, not just about what I have to accept in myself, but what others are going to say and see in me? And what are they going to do in response to that?
Yeah. And, the only reason that I knew to do this, because we can't give me too much credit here, is my best friend, Emily, at the time, 6 months earlier, she had gone on leave for burnout.
Oh, is that
and
right?
She had told me who she called because I said, oh my gosh, you're not going to be at work. Yeah. And she went on leave. She had been off for 6 months and I missed her. And I didn't understand what this thing was, but I knew that Emily was really hardworking and she was really amazing. And so the day it happened to me, the only reason I knew, I didn't know I was burned out, but the only reason I knew who I should call was that when something happened to Emily, she called this person and he knew what to do. Oh, so cool. I called him thinking, whatever's going on, he's probably going to know what to do. And this idea, you know, this needing to be useful, you're exactly right. When I was 6 or 7 years old, I remember walking outside my dad's office and he was on the phone and he was talking to somebody and he said, yeah, I mean, listen, it's just not my luck. Like the second one was a girl too. And all I ever wanted was a son who was an engineer. And that little girl, I don't know that she consciously knew, but in one of my dreams, it all came back to me. And I went back and talked to my dad and he said, I did want a son that was an engineer. So I think you're right. He said, I don't remember that conversation, but I do think that you may have overheard me saying that. I'm like, oh no, Dad, I know I've overheard it, but I didn't realize that it changed the trajectory of my life.
Everything in that moment gets affected
because
by that.
I couldn't be a boy for him, but I certainly could become the engineer. And if I was a disappointment, at least I could do the part that was mine to control.
Yeah, the parts that I can control. I may not be able to determine my, you know, my gender, but I can determine what I do with what I've got. And maybe that's going to be enough.
Yeah. And it's endless. I will tell you that my mom, I overheard her saying, when she speaks of her family, et cetera, she said, you know, I wanted to be a doctor, but my parents said, what kind of a mother and wife will you be if you're always on call for the hospital? And so we're not going to let you do that. So she went into biochemistry research, which in the end, I think was her great match in calling. But she always said, like, I didn't get to become a doctor. And I really hope one of my girls become a doctor. And I remember literally consciously saying, nobody needs to fight. Like, those things aren't mutually exclusive. I can do them both. I'll go to engineering school. I then will go to medical school and we'll have all that taken care of. So as if that was going to save everything. So
yes,
the day I realized it wasn't was this. Indian families, if you want to please your parents and you're on this mission, there's two things. There's definitely, like, growing up, there's your academics and athletics, okay? Become an engineer and a doctor and play tennis, okay? And the other one is give them lots of grandkids quickly. And so before 30 years old, they used to say to me, so Neha, when are you going to get married to a nice Indian boy? 30 came and went, and they started saying, hey, Neha, when are you going to get married? 38 came and went. And my traditional conservative arranged marriage Indian parents said to me, sat me down and said, give us grandkids. We don't care what order you do it in.
that was the next box to check for sure.
And I will tell you, I never got married. I do not have children. But I will tell you that my books, when they came out, my book, I wrapped it in a baby blanket and I gave it to my parents and I told them, these are your grand book babies. And they were not amused. They were not amused at all. But what I will say is when they started asking me after I had completed engineering and medicine and they were pushing for the marriage and the grandkids, right? That was when I realized that it didn't matter what mountain I climbed.
Yes.
And it didn't matter how hard I tried. This wasn't about that. This was, I better start learning what my mountain is, and I better learn what will make me happy.
We'll be right back after word from our sponsor.
Nearly 9 in 10 registered voters believe the nation faces a mental health crisis, according to a new USA Today Suffolk University poll. Americans are more concerned than ever about their mental health. Mental Health First Aid provides the resources and training to identify, understand, and respond to signs of mental health and substance use challenges. It provides the confidence and skills needed to offer life-saving assistance, and it provides peace of mind. Our experts provide mental health first aid training for adults, teens, caregivers, veterans, law enforcement, EMS, and school faculty. Mental health concerns are on the rise, but evidence-based training through mental health first aid can make a difference. Visit mentalhealthfirstaid.org to find a course near you or email hello@mentalhealthfirstaid.org to schedule a training. Courses are available for individuals, groups, organizations, and companies of all sizes. Visit mentalhealthfirstaid.org and make a difference in your community.
Yes. So we as children, we personalize things. We tend to be kind of egocentric, and the world happens because of us. And what we tend to do, we tend to make meaning of, well, we have to make meaning of things. So we make meaning of things via, this is what this says about me. Okay. And in order for this relationship to work, or for me in this case, not to be sent away, these are the things that I've got to do.
Yeah.
And then we hear these conversations about, had a son and wanted to be an engineer, or I had to forfeit maybe the ability to be a physician and do that work because I can't be a mom and be a doc. So you're going to do both, thinking unknowingly that if I do these, then I'm going to be essential. Then I'm going to be meeting their needs, and I'm going to be beyond value.
Yep.
That they can never send me away.
That's right.
And here I am. And what you're saying is such a key thing, Nahan. I admire and I so respect and appreciate your transparency around this, because this is such a helpful message. We think that if we don't often recognize that we're doing it, but we're living our lives maybe for somebody else in hopes that if I can, I get to secure an attachment for me that very early on in my life got ruptured and no one talked to me about it or helped me through that time. And I interpret it as, well, in order to prevent that from ever happening again, here's what I know possibly can work. I'm hearing conversations, I'm doing these things, I'm getting grades, everything else, playing tennis along the way. And these are the things that are going to secure something for me that's essential, never to experience that separation anxiety again. And little do we know that that's what's driving us.
Yeah.
And that our self-meaning is, I must not be of value enough or of worth enough just by who I am. And so these are the things that I find myself doing. And then you find out, wait a minute, I've checked all these boxes. I'm a doc, I'm an engineer. You got some other boxes for me now. That wasn't enough.
Yeah.
And how sobering that moment can be. Wow.
Yeah. I remember thinking, I love kids. I would be happy to have kids.
Yeah.
And what I knew very clearly inside me was, A, I wasn't going to do that alone. And B, I needed to find love first. And if the two of us wanted to create a family together, that was something I needed to do in partnership. And I had this real sense of knowing that this one wasn't up to me. This was me with the universe, like needing to figure out. And so I made a deal with myself, which was, listen, if I find love while I am able to have children, and we decide we want to do this, then I'll know it's the right thing.
Got it.
And if that timing doesn't work out, I may be born to be like the coolest aunt ever to everyone else's children.
I like
that. Shower them with gifts and love on them and, you know, do everything I can. And actually, you know, what's interesting is that secondary option, or that backup idea that came to me, it actually comes from another trauma, which is when I was little and I told you I came back into my family, I had an older sister who was 3 and a half and I was 2. Mm-hmm. She didn't do this consciously either, but she felt very threatened by a 2-year-old re-entering the family and having to split love with your parents. Yeah. Bad enough when you're a newborn and you're floppy and I can control you and I'm your older sibling, but it's quite different when it's a 2-year-old who's independent and thinks she's an only child.
Yeah.
So in I come, she starts bullying me. And I'm telling my parents, hey, like, this isn't working. Like, I think she's being mean to me. I think she's, and my mom's answer was, because all she ever wanted was a sister, she said to me, it's the only sister you've got. You two need to work it out. You need to figure it out. Well, I'm 2, she's 3 and a half. Yeah. Like, I'm not going to figure it out. Okay. No. Like, I'm little. And so the bullying began, and my mom's brother lived with us, Mukumama, and he saw some of the behavior that was going on. So he would help me. He would take me out of a situation where he saw that happening. He would say, hey, stop it. I see what you're doing. And he would call her out on it, right? So I started to become really, really close to him. Him and I would go on play dates together. Like, he'd take me to the carnival. We'd compete, you know, the ring toss, and he'd win me stuffed animals and all those kinds of things. But I found a haven in him.
Yes.
And so as I got older, and he was like a cool uncle, like he rode motorcycles and flew planes and all the things that I was like, oh, you're just so cool. Sure. And I think I almost substituted him as that love for a little girl with a father that came to me. And so I remember I was 10 years old and he asked me, he said, you know, me and nine buddies bought a plane and I want to take you flying. And I was like so excited about it. So it was a Sunday and we were supposed to go flying or whatever. And it was our first time doing it in a four-seater plane. And about 30 minutes before he left, he said to me, for whatever reason, he was like, hey, Neha, my buddy and his two kids are going to go on the plane and I'm not going to take you. And I literally, for a girl who really made sure her external environment was always taken care of, I had like a meltdown and I was like, why would you take them instead of me? And you can't take them. In the end, he took them in a hot air balloon, drifted onto the airport like area. You know how nothing is supposed to drift onto there. So he tried to avoid the plane and another plane landed on him and he died that day. And I have to say that I can feel it in me, my love for the role that someone who's an aunt or an uncle can play in someone's life is so clear.
I love that.
Because he died that day. And once again, I thought maybe it was because I got mad at him, right? Like I yelled and screamed and said, you can't do this. And it's only later in my life that I can tell you that when you lose people, or at least my experience of when you lose people in the physical world, it's almost like you lose seeing them in the physical world, but then they live so prominently in your heart and they're with you all the time. And so I wrote this in my book, but his presence and impact on me is what has me meet the most incredible people on the airplanes. I always think of him as protecting me. Other people get nervous and need Xanax and all these things when they're flying. Yeah. I just close my eyes and I'm like, he protected me that day. He's going to take care of me today. And so I have this always this feeling like he's in the cockpit, like things are handled.
Yeah.
And so whenever what I noticed as I got older, because this all ties into purpose as well, I think our greatest wounds, knowing what moves us to tears and what moves us to joy and ecstatic levels is what gives us the clues to our true purpose in life. And so during the pandemic, I started many years earlier, I started this too, but I just started doing classes for my clients, their children. And through the pandemic, there were 150 of them that I ended up doing all day online workshop, 18 weeks that I taught them. And I've taken many of them through years and years of communication and self-awareness training. And I realized that that's why I feel so fulfilled. And that's why it was a backup option for me that didn't feel like a backup, but felt really purposeful.
Very purposeful. From those tears to joy.
Yeah.
And being able to kind of maintain or kind of continue this legacy.
Yep.
That your uncle had in your life and the meaning of that relationship that you now get to steward in the lives of others. What a wonderful story. I'm sorry about your loss.
Yeah.
But what a way to take it to a place of joy and purpose in your own life.
And now what I think of it as is I almost think of it as it's given me some answers about what the world needs right now. I think we need sacred exchanges. I think I feel a sacred exchange on with you today. I feel it when I sit next to someone and I have a great conversation with them on a plane. I think that we are divided in the world, in our families, with our friends, and within ourselves because we've stopped having the conversations that matter.
I couldn't agree with you more. I love this phrase, sacred exchanges. Why that term? That's a beautiful term. Why did you come up with that? What's it mean?
Well, I just realized that my whole life, I became an engineer to please my father, and they taught me how to build physical bridges in the world. I became a doctor for my mom, and I learned about the breakdown of the physical body. But as a doctor, when I help someone through their physical heart attack, stroke, pneumonia, whatever it is, what makes the exchange sacred or turns a doctor into a healer is when I care about their emotional fear, when I ask them about what it means to them. It takes something that's a transaction and it makes it a sacred exchange. And so what I realized was that maybe I learned to, you know, cut people open and stitch them up and build physical bridges in the world. And these were all physical repairs. But I think my true purpose was that little girl whose internal world was shattered. And my job was to rebuild the invisible bridges within me so that I could then help build the invisible bridges between our hearts, which is what I refer to as sacred exchanges.
Yeah. So that bridge building within ourselves, with others, that's the engineering piece. And then the physician side is, and in doing so, there gets to be a healing.
You bet.
I love that. What, you couldn't have been in two more perfect careers. Those are just.
Now I look back and I'm like, thank you. Thank you, mom and dad. Thank you.
Exactly. That's great.
Yeah.
That's
now great. I'm an executive coach. And so I teach, I spend a lot of time with CEOs and executive teams teaching them this, and I'm moving really into doing company-wide wellness programs because why do I just do this for the C-suite? Why are we not, we all need this. We're all in a world moving faster than our biology can handle. And by the way, we all co-created it.
You bet.
In our minds, we think faster is better, do more with less, all of this. We're the ones who are co-creating. Success is more this year, do more with less, all of these things. So I want to just tie it back, which is I have now gone back and had the conversations with my parents where I've said to them, I know that you wanted these things for me, but I know that it wasn't you who made me do them. I wanted your love, approval, and the security of belonging more than anything. I'm the one who signed the applications, did the 36-hour shifts, did the problem sets, took the tests. So I wanted it more than you pressuring me, right? It's not like, oh, it's their fault. But I do have to say, if I got, you know, swayed into anything, now what I say to them is, you guys gave me such an interesting backdrop to and perspective to my career. I might as well give them the credit for that then as well. If I'm going to blame them for, you know, hey, you guys, you said these things that made me go into it. When it works out, I better also give them the credit that like, you guys are kind of geniuses.
Little did you know it. What I love about that is I love your generosity to them. And I think that's a real act of love in that moment to say, hey, you guys did some good things here and thank you. And then we get to say, well, you know, maybe I didn't need love and approval and security, and maybe I didn't get it quite the way that I wanted to or needed to, and maybe I developed some of these things, but if I can grow out of that and I can develop a purpose out of that, maybe my love and my approval, and my security now, which is my responsibility.
That's right.
To meet, I get to do this in very purposeful ways and very meaningful ways. And maybe part of that love and approval and security comes through those bridges and the healing that gets to take place and the relationships that get made now. And it's interesting because when we share those kinds of things, when we share ourselves in those exchanges, it's not that I'm being useful to you. It's that I'm sharing myself with you.
Yeah. It's that you trust yourself enough and you trust me enough to share what's close to your heart.
And if that gets exchanged, I'm never going to send you away. And you're never going to send me away.
Yeah.
Because there's something deeper in that exchange.
There's something very deep in that exchange. And let's say one of us leaves this earth, or we do leave, right? The whole experience is there's no regret. There's a fullness in the connection. And it's complete even in that connection.
That's right. You
know? So it feels whole and complete. You know, I have a picture of my two-year-old, and I carry her around with me. What I do when it's time to make a hard decision is I bring her and what she needed. I acknowledged that I'm the adult that she needed.
You bet.
And I always say, like, even if I'm making a hard decision, even if maybe I have to leave a friendship, even if I have to tell someone that I can't do something that they really want me to do.
Right.
I always look at her and I say, like, you and me, we're together now.
There you go.
Not going to leave you. Not going to leave you for anyone else. And as long as we are together, I'm never alone, actually.
Isn't that cool? Isn't that true? And I'm what a wonderful message. Talk about love, approval, and security.
Yeah. Let me grab it.
Oh, I love that.
Here she is. She's got lots of curls and, you know, like bright-eyed. My older sister actually gave this to me. It's like a paperweight. Yeah. And so I always keep it near me. And whenever I'm confused, I always get clarity just by having that with me. I've taken a picture of it and I keep it in my phone. People who aren't into whether it's their own, you know, mental health, self-awareness, et cetera, You say something like an inner child or a younger child, they're like, oh boy, like, what are you talking about? And I just got to say, those parts of us that had trauma or didn't, sometimes it's obvious trauma, like I was sent away and then left my grandparents. And sometimes it's just, I'm the fourth child and nobody was really paying attention. My needs aren't getting met. And it could be something as simple as that. Or I was the last one picked at kickball, like nobody wanted me, right? And so I think this whole idea of who we are and knowing ourselves is actually the key to finding our true purpose and happiness. And the coolest thing happened last night. I'm heading to the World Happiness Summit. I'm speaking there in London. And yesterday at dinner, I went to dinner with someone who said to me, so tell me, this is the third year you're speaking at the World Happiness Summit. Are you actually happy? And I had never really had somebody ask me that. And I said, well, it's not like every day, all the time, I'm happy. But what it is I've become a self-cleaning oven so that anytime something comes up, I'm irritated, I'm frustrated, I'm whatever, I have the tools and the capacity and I express it. It goes out in the moment. It's like I'm a toddler again, except I know how to do it artfully. So I have the conversations, I feel the emotions, I move things through me, and then I'm clean again. And so I'd have to say, yeah, I'm happy.
Isn't that cool?
And that was amazing. So
yeah, I think there are ways for us to be happy. But what I'm hearing you say is there's also an underlying kind of groundedness in your ability to experience love, your own approval, the security, and to give that to that little girl. She is so lovely in that picture you just showed us, that she never again has to feel afraid ever.
No.
Yeah, she's lovely. And so you get to hold a sense of contentment that I'm okay.
Yeah.
Things are going to be okay. We're going to be okay. And from that, boy, we can launch in so many directions.
We can take risks. And when things aren't okay, we have each other.
You bet. You bet. Now, I couldn't think about a better way to spend our time today. And I would agree with you. It is just what you said earlier. It is a sacred exchange. And it's a real exchange. It's a very heartfelt and transparent exchange, vulnerable exchange, but I can't think of a better way for us to recognize those early things in our lives that can not just impact our lives, but can lead to burnout and dissatisfaction and unhappiness and all those things. And without having an awareness of that, then all we are is just trying to problem solve at a kind of a surface level. And what you're saying is we can solve those things at a surface level, which I want to have you come back for. Yeah. You do all these wonderful things, you know, in the field, working with organizations and this new book you talked about and how you empower organizations and really have this wonderful comprehensive employee accountability program that I want to get into. But I can't think of a better way to start today and an intro into talking about what you do professionally now and how that's an outgrowth of your life. So what I like to do is I like to kind of bring our show today to an end. And as we do, I want to both invite you back to talk about what you're doing at a professional level and how it builds out of your personal life. But before we close, I'd like our listeners to be able to follow up with you in the meantime. And in order to do so, what are some ways that they can follow up after the show to learn about you and your book, Powered by Me?
Sure. So if they want to go on social, it's at DOCTORNEHA, at Dr. Neha, or Neha Sangwan, MD, on LinkedIn. If they want to check out our website, it's intuitiveintelligenceinc.com or nehasangwan.com. Those are the ways that they'll get that. And if they want to meet me live, there's live experiences. Like, I'm spending 5 days at the Omega Institute in June, where I will spend 1 day on physical energy, mental energy, emotional energy, social energy, and spiritual energy. Each year, I try to do something spacious that kind of takes away from our quick, 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 everything, you know, really quick. And I sit down and do something really intimate with the public. And so this is going to be the next opportunity to do that.
Fantastic. Fantastic. Those are great invitations. Well, Neha, again, I can't thank you enough for today and I'm going to be redundant here, but the sacred exchange and your willingness to kind of take us into these levels and these depths to show us that beautiful little girl that you have so well taken care of, given her love, her approval and security in life that allows its purpose now in your life to give to others in ways that they need those very things as well. And they get to experience those through you and then in their life, I'm imagining in very meaningful ways. And we're going to have you back. But for today, thank you so much.
Thank you.
I also want to thank you, our listeners, for dropping by and joining Neha and me today. It's always great to have you with us. I want to remind you that our episode archive and all of our resources for this episode can be found on our webpage at triadhq.com/BHT. Our podcast is on the Triad community, so come join us and our other mental health professionals at hellotriad.com. Thanks again for being with us on the show, and we'll look forward to having you back with us next time on Behavioral Health Today.
We appreciate all the support from our community, and if you like our show, one of the best ways you can support it is by giving us a 5-star rating and leaving a review. Behavioral Health Today is a podcast part of the Tribe Network, all rights reserved.